Welcome to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production. Hi, I'm Carol Bissett, a crime writer, and I invite you with my co-presenters, Liz Hedgecock and Mike Jackson, each week to our conversations on all things murderous. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Only Murders in My Mind. I'm joined today in the studio by my pal and co-writer author Liz.
Hello.
Mike's not with us this week, so we'll crack on. He's busy writing.
Indeed.
We hope.
Possibly like earwigging in a coffee shop somewhere.
Yes, yes. And which... good segue, which takes us into our topic. Where do we get our ideas from?
Yes, indeed.
And this was asked by a listener, Kevin Cannon. So, Kevin, this is for you.
Yep, hat tip. Thank you very much for suggesting it.
Yeah, and we are always up to do episodes from a listener's suggestions. So please don't feel that, you know, that we'll ignore that. We will take it on board and we will try and fit your suggestions in. Where we can. And this is something that we get asked a lot. And you know, one of my friends wants to know how I sleep at night because of the ideas I come up with. But
I think that's probably more than one of your friends who wonder how you sleep at night, Carol.
How do we come up with ideas? And sometimes they are a flash in the pan. As when I say flash in the pan, it's like, oh, yeah. And sometimes it's a slow burner and you think to yourself, that might work. And then you develop it in your mind. You're a good planner, aren't you, Liz?
Have my moments. But the thing is, you're not always in a place or a situation where you can just go, right, OK, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to work on this. So if nothing else, then I'll just, you know, send myself an email with the idea in the text somewhere. So that I've kind of got it for later. You know, like that thing where you have a brilliant idea in the middle of the night and you think, well, I'll remember that. I won't need to write that down. And then in the morning.
You don't.
Yeah. Or else, you know, you've scribbled something down if you keep a notepad, but you're like, oh, this is amazing. And then in the morning it'll say something like purple glove elephant. And you're like, what? What?
I put notes in my phone now and I've just put in here. This might be the title for a book. A murder mystery, find the why, and the why is just why.
Oh, okay. Ooh,
so
interesting.
Sometimes I'll start off with the title and my story will develop from the title. I found with the four detective novels that I've written, each one has the ideas have sprouted a little bit from the one before, but that happens in series, surely. It must do for you?
I think it quite often does, yeah. Or you'll kind of think, well, what have we not done yet?
Yeah.
It's an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think.
The titles are funny because like either I know the title before I start writing the book or else I can have written a whole book and be working on the edits and still like, I still don't know what this is going to be called. So,
well, I usually have a title first, but with the first in the Warrington Detective series, Searching for Evil. It was towards the end. That's where I got the title from. So I'd written most of it, and there was a phrase in it, and I thought, yes, that'd make a good title. Yeah. But with the others, I had the title right. I had an idea, and the title just cemented it.
I had something like what you said about your first one there with the House of Mirrors, because I didn't know what I was going to call it. I had all sorts of ideas. I mean, basically, for quite a while, the label on it on my computer was Utopia for Ducks. So I had no idea what it was going to be called. So I just went into a random title generator and went, okay, oh, we'll call it, you know. I mean, for now, it's going to be Utopia for Ducks.
Yes,
so,
why not?
Yes.
I think you should write a book with that title, actually.
Maybe I will. But yeah, it was something that when I was in the edits again for this book and a character says it, and I thought, actually, that would work well because, you know, at various points, one of the characters looks in a mirror and, you know, she sees something different every time. So I thought, yeah, that actually works fine. So I'll stick with that.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, the second detective one, which was The Vein Killer.
Mm.
My husband gave me the idea years ago when he said that if the government actually put out bad drugs, it would put people off taking them. Well, we know that's not true. That wouldn't work. Mm. I had this story in mind where somebody was perhaps killing people and making it look like they'd OD'd.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where that came from.
Right.
And of course, it's not vein as in vanity, it's vein as in a vein in your
veins
arm.
And arteries, yeah.
And is this killer so vain that he thinks he's going to get away with it? Mm-hmm. So it's a play on words.
Yes. I do like a title with a play on words, yes, or an ambiguous meaning. But yeah, I mean, thinking about it, when I started writing, I was doing flash fiction.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I had fairly young kids. I was still working full time. And, you know, flash fiction, you get to feel like you've actually written a whole thing.
Yeah.
And mostly the stories were inspired by a picture prompt or a word prompt. Because at the time, I think there still are quite a lot of these on Twitter, but there were lots and lots of kind of flash fiction contests, competitions.
Yes,
yeah. So there was a regular one called Flash Friday, and you'd have, I think, 24 hours. So the prompt would go up at whenever it was, and you'd have, you know, that time to post. And it'd normally be a picture, or it would be sometimes a word or a phrase. And those were really good for, you know, kind of getting you to think outside the box, because, you know, quite often you'd look at the picture and think, oh, there's this. And you think, yeah, that's the obvious thing. Let's go for something different. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, that was a good way to get things started. But
I know when I've done writer's courses.
Oh, yeah.
And they've given us all a title, mm, and said, you know, write 200 words on this. And there might be, I don't know, they weren't huge groups, but perhaps 10 people in the room, 10 completely different stories,
mm,
you know. And that just shows how you'd expect maybe one or two of them to be similar, the stories, but they weren't. They were all completely different.
Mm. Mm.
And that's a good exercise.
Yeah. I tend to like picture prompts better than word prompts.
Yes, yeah.
Or kind of, I don't really like long prompts.
Well, these were like the first sentence of the book,
mm-hmm,
and then you had to carry on writing.
Oh, okay.
I have done them with picture prompts, and they probably do spark off more in the imagination, mm, than just...
Yeah, because you've not just got words with those. You've got, you know, you've got colours, you've got shadows, you've got shapes, you've got, you know, potentially you've got characters.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Mm. Another thing that, and as I say, I watched a series about this, and I didn't realise I was doing it, but I do. I take some storylines from real murders.
Oh, okay.
Not so much how they were, well, it probably is how they were killed. but it won't be, you know, I'll have my killer. Mm. But the way that the story unwinds might be similar to something that's really happened.
Yeah.
Because they always say, isn't the life, true life is stranger than fiction.
Yeah. I must admit, some of the things that happen, you do occasionally think, if you put this in a novel, people have got to come off it.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yes.
But it's reassuring to think, as I say, when you read anything that's quite gruesome or anything like that, or even watch true crime, that it is, you know, it happens so rarely, you know, in that type of setting. Mm. Nearly always anybody that's attacked or murdered, it's by somebody that they know very well.
Oof.
It's not usually a stranger.
Mm.
You know, don't make things any better, but it, you know, no, it's things like, you know, locking up your house at night and not having to worry about people breaking in and coming and stabbing you to death in bed.
Yes.
And on that happy note, let's go and do some.
Yes, definitely. But yeah, I mean, I suppose in terms of like idea generation, my tip would probably be go and do something else.
Yes.
So it's that classic thing of it'll happen while you're on a walk or while you're doing the ironing, and you know, something will occur to you.
Mm.
And it kind of, it's when you're doing something that's not too taxing. So, you know, you can easily, like, you know, go for a walk, have a little think, you know, maybe listen to some music on your headphones or whatever. And none of that stops you thinking.
No.
And it's what, I'm going to have a go at pronouncing this, but Csikszentmihalyi. There we go. Bless you. sorry for the pronunciation. I'm probably completely wrong. But he talks about flow and about getting into a flow state. And it's one of the things where, you know, when you're at peak creativity, you'll, you know, you'll be completely in the moment and completely absorbed. And it's, you know, one of the reasons why I go for a walk when I'm dictating a book, because it gets, you know, a bit of my mind working and I've got something to do, and it just, you know, I just kind of go along and I go with the flow. And I think it's sometimes the same with ideas. And I've been reading a book recently. I think I've mentioned it on another podcast. I've been reading a book called Hyperfocus by Chris Bailey. And that talks about, it talks about hyperfocusing. And again, that thing where you're very intensely doing something and, you know, your mind is like on that and nothing is distracting you or interrupting you. It has some awful statistics about generally you get interrupted or you stop doing what you're meant to be doing about every 40 seconds.
Probably right.
Yeah, I know. It's a grim thought, isn't it? But he also talks about something like scatter focus.
Oh, right.
Which is kind of the obvious, where the opposite even, where, you know, you're sort of, you're doing something not too taxing and it leaves your mind free to do things like generate ideas, connect the dots, stuff like that. And I've tried this where you just go for a walk and you've, you know, you've got yourself a sort of a little problem to solve or something. Oh, I need to think about that. And I generally take my phone if I'm on a walk, 'cause it's easy just to start an email and, you know, talk into it and leave myself a little note. And yeah, it interrupts the music, but I can live with that. So you're not concentrating intensely, you're just sort of throwing ideas around and suggestions and things.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'll walk along and then, you know, something else will occur to you. And you're like, oh, I could do that.
Yeah.
Or what about this? Or what about if you reverse the order? Or
it's like just getting a big piece of paper, isn't it? And just writing things that pop into your head.
Yes. So
what was it Mike talks about? Is it
Free writing.
Free writing. Yeah. That must bring up some ideas as well.
Yeah.
And that's just, you just start off and carry on writing, don't you?
Yeah. And even if you're writing, I can't think of anything else to write, you still carry on writing because something will come along.
I know, like a lot of people during the lockdowns, I was determined to do a lot of writing. And like a lot of people, I just couldn't get there. Mm-hmm. And you gave me some really good advice and said,
once in my life.
No, you said just sit down at the computer and open your file and just write for 10 minutes. It doesn't matter what it is.
Mm.
And that got me back into writing again.
I think it's that thing of, you know, I'll just give it this long and if it doesn't go far, I can just go and do something else. But I need to just sit down and do my whatever it is. But yeah, I think I quite enjoyed like retreating into my fantasy world during the pandemic, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think I was fairly prolific, but...
Oh, and I've read a few, you know, sort of famous writers said them. I mean, I'm the one that does, he lives in Edinburgh.
Ian Rankin.
Thank you. See, she always knows who I mean.
Bing!
She's just slightly, you know, just reads my mind just a little bit. I remember him saying...
I'm like, what's his face? The Sphinx.
Oh, yeah.
Open your mind, Jimmy Carroll. Open your mind.
It's an age thing. I forget names. I remember reading an article about him, and then he did a sort of a live cast on the writers thing that they do in Edinburgh.
The festival.
The book festival. It's called a book festival.
Yeah.
It's not called a writers festival. And they had people talking, you know, from their homes and everything.
Mm.
And basically he said, I'm enjoying the solitude, the being able to actually sit and just write without going, having to go out and promote my books and being interviewed and doing things like book fairs and all this sort of thing. Because that's a side of it he doesn't like.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of writers actually... they're not keen on that side of it, but because writing is a very solitude career, isn't it? You just
sit there
on your own and just, you know, write. And to a lot of writers, having to go out and promote their books is not what they want to do, but it's part of the whole process of selling books.
It absolutely is. I remember going to a talk by Louise Doughty, and she was saying, I mean, she just had a big hit with Apple Tree Yard.
Yeah.
Which I think it just was in the process of being adapted, or it was, you know, the news was out as being adapted for TV. And one of the things she said was that, you know, in some way she felt more a writer in the sense of, you know, the sitting down and the writing and getting to it. She felt more of that kind of before she got more famous.
Mm.
So I think it's that thing where you do spend a lot of your time doing promotion-y things or not writing-y things.
Yeah, yeah. And as I say, he felt that he got on really well and did quite a lot of writing. And then, like me, there were very famous authors out there that really struggled. Mm. Mike said he likes to go out and write, and he sits in a coffee shop and he just...
And if your coffee shops aren't open anymore,
you're
a bit stuck.
I know he did say that he was it his 50th birthday? He got a bottle of beer out the fridge, went and stood outside his local pub and opened it and drank it outside the pub going, "Happy birthday." Happy birthday to me.
Oh, bless.
I mean, this is something I think all writers worry. When they're on a roll, it's great, but when the ideas, you know, they go through a dry spell, writer's block. I don't get that, but then I've not written an awful lot of books. I'm on my 9th book now.
That's quite a bit.
Yeah, true. I've usually, Liz and Mike both know this, if I get through the first two chapters, I'm okay. If I don't, if I'm struggling by the end of the second chapter, it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You will plot your...
Yes.
Book, so that you've got different areas and you get...
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my process normally is, I mean, you know, hopefully I've got some idea of something. I mean, there's, first of all, I suppose there's the kind of, right, well, what's the core idea of the book? What's going to happen in this one? I mean, when it's a series, I suppose, you know, if you're in the world of the series, then there will be certain things that are pretty fixed. So if it's a Booker and Fitch book, a Fee and Jade book, then I mean they're both going to be in it.
Yeah.
You know, and we're in a kind of a cozy-ish crime scenario, so it's, you know, it's not going to be anything horrendously, you know, violent or bloodthirsty or whatever, probably. You know, and it's probably not going to be a serial killer, so you know you've got some parameters there already. But you know, there'll be an idea. And often in that world, you'll be thinking, well, this is where they were at the last time we saw them. So how are they going to move on in this book? Where are they going to end up? You know, what else is going to happen? What the supporting characters doing? So there'll be stuff like that. So you've got your core idea and you'll be thinking about where the story beats come, or your, you know, the points in your characters' arcs, you know. And I mean, most books have a fairly similar structure in the sense of, you know, they'll be in the normal world to start with, and then something will happen that will throw them out of it. And there's, I mean, obviously there's going to be a crime that's going to be discovered fairly early on. Maybe there'll be another one along the way. And then, you know, about the halfway point, they will get more proactive. They'll stop reacting to things. And about three quarters of the way, give or take, you know, there's going to be a moment where they think they've got it, and no, they absolutely haven't, and they've made things worse for themselves. You know, and that crisis could be in the case, it could be personal crisis, it could be all sorts, all being chucked together. So,
yeah.
So, but, you know, and in the end, the mystery will get solved.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in the detective one, it's very often false starts, you know, they're not necessarily going down a rabbit hole, but this happens in real police work. They have to go and explore all the avenues that are open. If they've, you know, they've not got a really good idea of the person that's done the crime, they've got to investigate lots and lots of threads.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I suppose you can't just go after one, can you?
No, no. Mm. In this latest one, the detectives have to go and interview one of the victims' friends from university.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to go back to that sort of thing. And very often it doesn't lead anywhere, but they're eliminating those people.
Yes.
And usually, hopefully, finding out a little bit more about... Because they go and interview the person's mother who thinks the child is wonderful.
Yeah.
And but when they actually scrape a little bit below the surface and talk to their friends... No, they weren't that good.
Yeah,
they
were... or it'd be like, oh yeah, the mum never knew that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's
so
really
you get
life.
To triangulate that stuff, yeah, don't yeah, you, and yeah. test
you,
it,
and, you,
so.
And then you and you go back, but mm. Usually with mine, I finish a book with the first two or three pages of the next book,
mm-hmm.
and when I do that, I have a vague idea how it's going to be. But it is only vague at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's the thing. If you're writing mystery or crime, then you need a crime.
Yeah.
Of some kind. And, yeah. You know, you're going to need a motive and you're going to need suspects.
Yeah.
You know, so some of your process is going to be, you know, developing all of those because you can't just...
Yeah, why was that person killed? You know, I mean, that is the question. Usually if you can find out why they've been killed, you can very often then... jump to who would want to kill them sort mm-hmm. of thing. And the other thing I find as well is I now do a loose plot, but very often my characters will take me by the hand.
Oh, yes.
You know, and we've turned left instead of turning right.
Yeah.
I need a sat-nav.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes with my plots, there are bits where I'm like, I'm not quite sure how that's going to work out, but I've got enough here that I'm confident we'll get there.
Mm.
So, and it's usually something fairly minor that I thought, don't know about that, but you know, I'm normally fairly informed as to the why and the what and the who. So, I figure if you have those things and it kind of makes sense, because what I tend to do is I'll get the arc points in place and then I'll normally do like a two or three lines of of A4 size paper for each chapter. So just a little kind of summary thing. And the thing is, once I've got my arc points, you know. I'm going to write that book. It's not like it's going to get abandoned. So
no.
From that point, I'm just, you know, refining it a bit and getting to the point where I've got enough there that I can, you know, write that chapter outline and post-it note and take it out with me. And that will be the first draft of that chapter. So.
But I mean, with your latest series with Paula, I'm really invested in those characters now. And you have developed them very well. I want to know about the whole family. Yeah, I want to know what's going to happen next, even if they don't have a crime. I would read it. if they went on a shopping expedition to the nearest city, I would probably still read it because I like the characters. So, mm. Yeah, that's somebody actually got in touch with me that had read all my books and was horrified at one of the people I'd killed off. Absolutely.
I guess that's good.
Yes, she was good. She said she cried. She said, what did you do that for? And we were like, I do kill people off on a regular basis. Mm. You know, main characters sort of thing get killed off. But that's just the way I rock and roll.
So what sparked the Warrington Detective series?
Well, as I say, because of my love of all things crime related.
Yeah.
That sounds terrible, doesn't it? It sounds like I go around with a swag bag at night. fiction and real life crime. It is something that I'm absolutely fascinated about, and forensics, etc.
The Warrington element was that kind of write what you know.
Yes, somebody, one of our fellow writers, did actually say to me, "You're going to give people the wrong idea about Warrington." And I said, so,
yeah, because no one ever visits anywhere where a crime has ever taken place.
I mean, Death in Paradise, all the crimes that are committed in Oxford and Midsummer. It's really nice, Midsummer. So it was because I used to be a district nurse, so I know all the rat runs and I know all the little places and, I feel I know the town as well as I know any town.
Yes.
So that's why I wanted it, and also because it's the Cheshire serious crime, we can then go to Frodsham, and yes, you know, we can go to Norton Priory and places like that.
Yes,
that actually aren't in Warrington.
Yeah, and you can do kind of different sort of bits of Warrington.
Yes,
so, yeah, you can do Stockton Heath, you can do Orford, you can do wherever you like.
Depending. Yeah, go all over the place. So
and
as I say, it's the people that buy them really, really enjoy them, and they're probably the people I'm writing for, aren't they?
There you go.
So they'll never be a millionaire, but what would I do with all that money?
Ooh, let's pause and consider that a moment.
No, I'll carry on writing them as long as I enjoy writing them. And when it gets, as I say, it was supposed to be a trilogy. I think it says in my first book, it's a trilogy. And now, now it's a series.
Well, I mean, a trilogy is a series as far as I'm concerned.
It's true,
I mean, I think I've just got too many ideas that I don't think I'll ever get to write them all.
Yes, got all percolating in you.
Yeah, well, generally if I've got a note, I'll kind of stick it in the back of my mind. And if it keeps bothering me, you know, and kind of gathering other little bits, like the idea of connecting the dots I said earlier, then I kind of figure, okay, this is possibly a goer, and I might, you know, get a sheet of paper and do some scribbling and draw some arrows and do stuff like that. But
be like my murder board, won't it?
Probably, I do have a whiteboard at home.
Yes.
Not a murder board, though.
No. Well, my murder board are A4 sheets, but I do, I do, you know, timelines and things on it. So if I had space in the office or the studio, I probably would have one, but I haven't really. It's all taken up. Did you want to read something?
I could do.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so this is a sort of an example of where I got an idea from. So House of Mirrors, my first full-length novel, was partly sparked by an article a friend gave me, which was about Mrs. Hudson. And she was having a bit of a clear out, you see, and she had a photocopy of it, and she went, oh, do you want this? And I said, oh, this looks interesting. So I had a bit of a read of it, and it was all about, you know, Mrs. Hudson and her kind of, you know, her slightly mysterious quality, and you know, she's, you know, sort of a, you know, she's a landlady rather than a housekeeper, and we don't really know that much about her. And I got to thinking, and I can't remember if it was at the same time or slightly later or even beforehand, but I've been rereading A Study in Scarlet, and it struck me how well looked after Holmes and Watson are. You know, they barely have to lift a finger. I know the meals are done for them, you know, they have to think about things like their boots because, like, the page will clean the boots and, you know, and they're just so very privileged, really. And they just have all this freedom to, you know, play around detecting and, in Sherlock's case, you know, running all over London in disguise and stuff like that. And you think, you pair of big kids. And it kind of reminded me of Douglas Adams' book, which has the electric monk in it, and he sits on a horse all the time, and the horse is thinking, you know. And one of the things that is observed is, you know, you can sit on top of something all day and you won't think about that, but if you're sat on all day, you will definitely have opinions about, you know, the person sitting on you.
Quite right.
Yeah, so I kind of wanted to, you know, get that. And that was kind of what sparked the book. You know, you have this woman who's got to wait on these guys, and, you know, she's probably resentful and, you know, what about, you know, what about her life? Because she's probably got opinions about them, even if they don't think about her.
And she's a very intelligent woman as well.
Yeah, clearly.
Very intelligent woman.
So this is a kind of a bit that was partly inspired by that. I'll read an excerpt for you. So this is where Holmes and Watson are moving in. I hurried down to a key in the door at just after 9 in the morning. Mr. Holmes was laden with bags, which he deposited in the hallway just as the cabman came through the door with a large square black box in his arms. Where shall I put this, sir? Leave it in the corner, if you would. Carefully now. Mr. Holmes went back outside. Can you give me a hand upstairs with this? He called. The cabman left, and a minute later his back reappeared, followed by an enormous brown leather trunk with Mr. Holmes on the other end. They progressed jerkily up the stairs, and the trunk bumped down overhead. Mr. Holmes gave the cabman half a crown, for which he tipped his hat. Good day to you, sir. You sure you haven't left anything behind, Holmes? Said Dr. Watson, smiling. Mr. Holmes frowned. I hope not. This is my professional equipment. The rest of the morning and most of the afternoon was full of scraping from the rooms below as the gentlemen moved the furniture about. I popped in to offer tea and luncheon, but they dismissed me over their shoulders and took their lunch at a restaurant. I peeked into their rooms, which reeked of tobacco, when they were out. Dr. Watson's was quite plain, and apart from necessities, the only ornament was a painting of a landscape over the mantel. Mr. Holmes's room was overstuffed with belongings. A violin case, some half-assembled chemical equipment, necktie strewn on the bed. I had not expected him to be a dandy in the matter of clothes. In the sitting room, the bookcase was filled with new volumes. Apart from a few medical textbooks, a Bible and a complete Shakespeare, all were penny dreadfuls. I opened the silver card case which lay on top of the bookshelf. Sherlock Holmes, consulting detective, 221B, Baker Street. The card was a thick cream pasteboard, the black lettering deeply engraved. Mr. Holmes had lost no time in getting established. Over the next few days, we settled into a routine. Mr. Holmes would ring for hot water at 7, followed by breakfast at 7:30, while Dr. Watson was close to 2 hours later in his habits. Neither required lunch as a rule, but both were usually into dinner at 6:30, followed by a light supper at 9:30. Mr. Holmes's movements were unpredictable. He might go to the laboratory, or for a long walk, or lie on the settee scraping at his violin, my least favourite of his occupations. Dr. Watson generally stayed at home in the mornings and took a walk to his club at midday, returning in the afternoon to read until dinner. At least, that was what I could gather, as both men were polite but sparing in their communications towards me. One morning, Mr. Holmes was in a lethargic mood. He breakfasted at the same time as Dr. Watson, and when I collected the breakfast things, he was curled on the settee, staring into the fire, while Dr. Watson was writing a letter at the bureau. "Not going to the lab today, Mr. Holmes?" I had to ask the question twice. He flapped a hand at me. "No, Mrs. Hudson, I am thinking. Please do not disturb me." I raised an eyebrow at Dr. Watson, who appeared oblivious to this exchange, and left the room laden with dirty crockery. As I carried the tray down, I heard a low exclamation. "What a busybody." The phlegmatic tones of Dr. Watson replied, "She's a childless widow, of course she's going to fuss." I thumped down the stairs, resolving that I would engage a maid of all work as soon as I could. Housekeeping for two rude, thoughtless gentlemen was a poor substitute for the analytical work I'd done in the past, and now that I had two paying lodgers, the expense was more than justified. I set Billy to wash the plates and retired upstairs to compose an advertisement. Before I sat down at the desk, though, I stood before the glass. I saw a woman in a plain purple dress with her hair scraped back from her face. A busybody. A childless widow. I turned my back on her and took up my pen. The quicker I could get domestic help, the less time I would have to spend waiting on the ungrateful pair downstairs.
Yes, exactly.
Ha!
Oh, and again, I love the way her character develops through the books. She becomes a different person, doesn't she, really? She finds her own voice and, yeah.
Well, I think she, you know, I think she always has her own voice, but by the end of the book, people really listen.
Yeah, they do, yeah. Mm. So, right, I think that brings us to...
So
once again, thank you very much for listening. I keep saying the same things, don't I? It's very, very nice to know that we've got so many listeners, and if you want to press all the buttons on the YouTube thing.
Subscribe, enable notifications. Yes. And never miss an episode.
Ding, dong, ding. But yes, as long as you are listening and enjoying, that is the main thing.
Yep. And if you have feedback for us or suggestions, feel free to comment or contact us.
Yes, we like to hear from you. Mm. So until next time, same place. We're here every Thursday at 5 p.m. And until then, goodbye.
Bye.
You have been listening to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production, produced by John Bissett. The music In Peril was composed and recorded by OM Studio Strings.